This is day three of this January 2014 Rohatsu 7-day session. We'll return to our text. We left off in called the Way of Korean Zen, which presents the teachings of the 20th century Korean Zen master Kusan Sunim. And here we're going to pick up a little section called Stages of Meditation. And these are his words. When people discuss the practice of meditation, they often refer to a person having either a superior, intermediate, or inferior capacity for this task. The danger with reading something like this is the people who insist on thinking about themselves and who want to categorize themselves will run with this and think about whether they might be the superior, the intermediate, or the inferior category. But it is a time-honored analogy in Buddhism, and it has some merit to it. There are two analogies from a sutra called the Anguttara Nikaya Sutra, and these words are attributed to the Buddha. And here's how it goes. I'm reading from Robert Eakin Roshi's The Gateless Barrier. And it goes like this. The one who learns that someone in another village is about to die and reflects on the transient nature of all life is like a horse who runs when it sees the shadow of the whip. So there's one, a monk who doesn't need to go through a lot of suffering himself to recognize the human predicament, and that we all will be gone someday, and that there's a practice here that we can, in which we can use to do something about it, to come to terms with that. So that's the one who learns that someone in another village is about to die. That's what the Buddha is calling a horse who runs when it sees just the mere shadow of the whip. And then now the other three. The one who learns that someone in his own village is about to die and reflects on the transient nature of all life is like a horse who runs when it is whipped to the hair. The one who learns that someone in his family is about to die and reflects on the transient nature of all life is like a horse who runs when it is whipped to the flesh. And finally, bringing up the rear, the one who learns that he himself is about to die and reflects on the transient nature of all life is like a horse who runs when it is whipped to the bone. Meaning, it runs only when it is whipped to the bone. It takes that much prodding to get that horse to run. Now, the problem with making the mistake of categorizing yourself as one of these types of horses is that we are constantly changing. We're not stuck with any identity. We're not stuck with any self that's unchanging. We are changing it. We're changing it in the most rapid, effective way we can in coming to Zen practice and especially to Sesshin. And he makes that point himself here. He says when people discuss the practice of meditation, so he says either superior, intermediate, or inferior capacity for this task. So here, these are just three rather than four categories. Then he says, however, these capacities are not inborn qualities. For once a strong motivation has been generated, then a person is immediately endowed with a superior capacity. So it's the motivation, it's the commitment that endows us with this great potential. No matter where we might have come from, he says, but nevertheless, there are different levels of motivation. Some people may leave the care of their parents and relatives and become monks or nuns with the sincere motivation to realize Buddhahood. But after practicing for a while, they discover that the aim of meditation is not achieved as easily as cooling hot porridge by pouring cold water on it. Such persons may become disheartened when their practice does not proceed as smoothly as they had expected. However, a person of superior capacity is able to completely cut off the mind of discrimination as soon as he is told to do so. But for those who are unable to do this, much hardship, effort, and total determination are needed before they can achieve this state. So we are the architects of our fate. There's nothing more more clear in Zen teaching that we can reform ourselves, we can remake ourselves through this practice. The longer we practice, the more we nurture this faith mind, that it really is the fuel, the ground of all serious practice. And start from a quite unpromising position, and with that faith, then there's no limit to what we can do. Roshi Kaplow, when he went back to Japan some 6 years after the war ended, and placed himself in Zen training at Hoshinji, but all he had going for him was this tremendous need to see into his true nature. He had lived in a somewhat dissolute way up till then. He was so out of shape, he had a terribly, terribly difficult time with it at first. He told me in Doksan once that he was in early sesshin, he was in such discouragement that he made it as far as the gate of the monastery. He was on his way out, enough of this stuff, and somehow he was had a change of heart when he got there. Awfully, awfully tough row to hoe that man had. But underneath it all was this need. That came first, was the need. And the need to come to terms with life and death. That's what drove him to practice. And the more he practiced, the more the faith grew. The more the faith grew, the more motivation he had. And here we all are. He told me he hated Sesshin. He hated it. What could have got him to continue going to Sesshin? 56 Sesshins before he got through Mu. What could have driven him to keep coming back to do something he hated so much, other than this need, this non-negotiable, in a way, desperate need to know, to find out? And now, Kusan Sunim continues. Most people who meditate on a koan intend at the outset to keep a firm hold on it. But usually, after a very short while, their koan disappears and they just lose themselves in thoughts. If someone persists in such a way, when will he ever awaken? In other words, persists in just dwelling in thoughts. Others, after a few initial attempts to hold on to the koan, find that it does not appear to them spontaneously. So they just sit still without doing anything at all. Such people then ask me, "What do you claim there to be? Surely there is just nothing." This type of pose is one we read about in various accounts, Zen texts. The student will come and airily declare, "Well, there is nothing. Really, there's just nothing. So there's nothing to do, there's nowhere to go," and so forth. We don't get many of those. Every once in a while, someone will bring that into Doksan. But they snap out of it pretty quickly when they see what a notion it is. It's merely some idea that has sort of lodged in their mind temporarily. He addresses this more. The problem here is that although they tried to hold on to the koan, they found nothing they could take firm hold of, and they conclude that there is nothing at all. But such conclusions are only reached intellectually. Indeed, as long as you continue just to scheme and conceptualize with the intellect, you will find nothing to take firm hold of. But to then proclaim that in reality there is just nothing is mere foolishness. I have a scroll in my quarters at Arnold Park that Roshi Kaplow had there, same place in those quarters, calligraphy that reads, "From the very beginning, there has never been a single thing." Well, what about that? Some Zen master did that. He's not the first one. This is a core aspect of the Buddhist experience. From the very beginning, there's never been a single thing. This is the doctrine of shunyata, no thingness, emptiness, voidness. It's one thing for someone who has realized the void nature of reality to make that statement. It's another thing when someone who hasn't makes that statement. Then it's not real. It's not true. He continues, "It is essential to take firm hold of the koan and to continuously advance in your practice. This is the same whether you are investigating the koan, what is this, mu, or the cypress in the courtyard. This is a famous short koan in the Blue Cliff Record. Another translation is the oak tree in the garden, the cypress in the garden. Initially, you do not understand at all what is meant by these questions. Therefore, in order to fully understand their meaning, you must seize hold of the koan and penetrate deeply into it with incessant questioning. It is really very simple. You don't understand what is meant. Thus, it is necessary to find out through constant questioning. If you did understand, then, of course, there would be no need for any such questioning. It is quite meaningless to simply repeat the koan mechanically in your mind without a sense of questioning. Well, there is something between questioning and repeating the koan mechanically, and that is to absorb oneself in the koan. Let's use mu. It's the most common one, most commonly worked on here, is to just become completely one with mu, the word mu, even if you're not questioning. Now, questioning is the best. If you can question genuinely, wondering what mu is, or what this is, or who am I, if that questioning is authentic and really sincere, that's the best. But many people find that the questioning, when they try to question, it just is coming from the outside. It's not genuine. And if that's the case, then rather than questioning, making it artificial, it's nearly as good to just absorb yourself, concentrate on the koan itself without the questioning. Nearly as good. And moreover, as when you reach a certain depth of absorption in the koan, even without the questioning, it gives rise to puzzlement. Gives rise to the questioning. At a certain point, the sheer concentration on the koan then blossoms into questioning. But mechanically, no, that doesn't do much good, just to repeat it over and over again. There must be engagement with it. Get into it. Doing it mechanically will just leave you bored. Like doing anything mechanically will leave you bored. When you first try to meditate, you may find that no matter how strong your resolve is to firmly hold the koan, the mind is constantly besieged by wandering thoughts, and it seems impossible to progress in the practice. Okay, we all know that. So what should be done to correct this problem? At such times, you must completely forget about what has happened in the past. For what benefit is there in continuing to think about things that have already ceased? Likewise, you should desist from speculating about what might happen in the future. For since it will be determined by various conditions, what can your present thoughts do to influence the course of future events? So, okay, very logical, very sensible. We can't affect the past. We can't really affect the future. And so there's no point in dwelling in our memories or our plans, our rehearsals, our worrying. Your sole function, he says, during a meditation session is to sit on the meditation cushion, investigate your koan, and awaken to its meaning. Other than this, there's nothing to do. So why do you needlessly waste this precious time by entertaining thoughts about what has been and what might be? Well, we know why. The reason is out of habit. We're so, this habit of fleeing into the past or into the future is so strong. We've gotten away with it our whole life, and it's very hard to stop that momentum. But with enough determination, with enough commitment to the practice, we can find our way out of that tendency to flee from the present, to flee from the practice. It's the same thing. The practice is the present. And he says, however, as soon as you manage to cut off all thoughts of the past and future, you will experience a state of emptiness. This occurs because at that moment, both before and after are severed. If you cannot reach this state because of an inability to control your thoughts about the past and future, then you cannot be considered a true practitioner. Remember, your sole responsibility is to awaken through inquiring into the koan. Now he says more about this state of emptiness that one can slip into when one is finally unshackled from memories and thoughts about the future. Once before and after have been severed, you enter a state of emptiness. Now at this time, there is a danger that you might easily slip into a state of just observing the emptiness. In such a condition, you are neither disturbed by sleepiness nor wandering thoughts, but in addition, the koan is also absent. Let's just make sure this is clear, because there will be people in this sesshin who will get into this state, and they need to beware. So you're not drowsy, you're not falling asleep, you're quite with it. And you don't have your thought, you're beyond thoughts, but the koan has now disappeared. This is a real crucial challenge, because somehow you have to get it back. I'll let him say that. If you just observe the emptiness in this way, you will become a spineless insect. Who would want that? You know, we can laugh about such a thing, but to someone like Khusan Sunim, born in 1909, and certainly to his predecessors, many of the great masters, they spoke very freely about how getting caught in some kind of an unhealthy state of mind can lead to an unfavorable rebirth. And who's to say they're not right? Maybe we are so sophisticated psychologically that this sounds silly to us, but who knows? But we'll just move on. Thus, it is a mistake to merely observe the emptiness. Moreover, you should not even allow the thought to arise that you are not observing it. Likewise, try to discard even the idea that you should not allow such a thought of non-observing to arise. And finally, you should let go of that idea as well. So who hasn't been there with this... with this endlessly, this observing mind that just seems to recede no matter how many levels we reach. It's somehow, it's always someone watching us, watch ourselves, watching us. Blah, 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 blah. I think of when I was a kid, in our house we had a narrow part of the house, a kind of a dormer, where there was a mirror on each side, and you learned that you could put your hand between the two mirrors, and just in either mirror you could just see the hands just receding often endlessly into the distance. This can be quite painful when people get into this, and they no matter how hard they're working, usually it's because they're getting really concentrated that they continue to see this observing mind, and they can get frustrated. No matter what I do, I am always, there's someone watching or commenting or judging. How do I break? Will this ever stop? Is this question that comes up? Can I ever have this subject object duality disappear? And of course the answer is yes. Don't be discouraged when you find ever more subtle layers of observing happening. Many before you have had that happen who then eventually see that it all vanishes. The voice falls silent. He continues, you will then reach a point where all mental content is relinquished. So the mind is utterly empty. Short of the koan. At that time, since all circumstances are absent, if you take hold of the koan, it will appear with extreme vividness and clarity. When he says all circumstances are absent, this means there's no environment apart from oneself. There's no outside standing apart from inside. There's no two-ness. If you take hold of the koan, it will appear with extreme vividness and clarity. By concentrating on the koan in this fashion for a period of a few days, a state of quiescence and vividness will begin to clearly emerge. At this time, there is the danger of easily succumbing to the misconception that you have awakened. However, this is not an experience of awakening. It is merely a perception of the luminous nature of consciousness. He continues, if at such time you become distracted by circumstances, what is appearing to you will fade and finally become covered up. What is appearing to you, well, one way to refer to that is this original mind, this self-nature that has become revealed when the thoughts finally subside. But he's warning, if you become distracted by circumstances, that will fade and finally become covered up. Okay, distracted by circumstances. This is why we are so strict about silence in Sesshin, about keeping the eyes down. This is a crucial, crucial point. And to be distracted at such a time can, temporarily leave this bright mind obscured again, and that can have consequences. there's no way we would ever have to, we could ever lose this luminous original mind of ours. But it does get covered up if we get distracted. We can always find our way back there, but when? When will the conditions be as favorable as in a sesshin? Therefore, he says, make a great effort not to be distracted and instead continue to hold on firmly to the koan. At this time, the koan is said to be ripening and the mind starts to become sharper and more single-pointed, like a fine sword. It is vital at this point to pursue your practice with the intensity of an attacking soldier. You must become totally involved with the koan to the exclusion of everything else. We used to have in the guidelines that were read in the opening night of sesshin, the guidelines ended with the words to pursue your practice with fanatical single-mindedness. This is what's called for. He uses a favorite analogy you find in Chinese and Japanese and Korean Zen, of the soldier, the warrior. Understand, this doesn't mean it means with the yes, fanatical single-mindedness of an attacking soldier. Doesn't mean putting oneself in opposition to the practice. That would be ridiculous. It's the whole point is to see that mu, or whatever a practice is not other. It's not apart from us. But the martial analogies would fit in terms of facing death. It's a desperate situation, which, thank Buddha, most of us have never had to face. But when your life is on the line, when you're facing death, then this is the kind of intensity that's required. You must become totally involved with the koan to the exclusion of everything else. If you can make your body and mind become identical with the koan, then in the end, ignorance will naturally shatter. You will fall into a state of complete unknowing, perplexity, and questioning. But this is not a final or lasting state. When you have reached this point, you must still proceed further to the stage where although you have ears, you do not know how to hear. Although you have eyes, you do not know how to see. And although you have a tongue, you do not know how to speak. This is just a way of saying that you're beyond self-consciousness. You've completely lost yourself to the koan. To reach the place where mountains are not mountains and rivers are not rivers may entail several years of hard practice. Therefore, it is necessary to cast aside all other concerns and train yourself to focus the entirety of your attention on the tasteless koan alone. Tasteless. This is how it can become. Even in states of deep absorption, it's not a pleasant state. Tasteless. Having faced the koan over and over again, sesshin after sesshin, year after year, there are times when it can be tasteless. Zen Master Hakuin referred to those vile koans. It's not meant to be fun. this reference to, he says, when you reach the place where mountains are not mountains and rivers are not rivers, this is yet another metaphor. It's always been around in Zen practice, where in the beginning, mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. Yeah, whatever. Okay, so yeah, trees are trees, dogs are dogs, cats are cats. Boring. The second, then you get deeper into practice, and somehow those mountains are no longer the same. They're not mountains. Rivers are not rivers in the same way. It's hard to say how they've changed, but they're not the same. And then after the breakthrough, then mountains are mountains. Rivers are rivers. Dogs are dogs. Ruff. Cats are cats. Wonderful. This is what the sutras refer to as the suchness of things, sometimes the thusness of things. Their utter, exquisite suchness. He continues, by proceeding in this way, what is appearing will become even brighter, and after a short while, you will reach a state in which you cannot move an inch in any direction. Even if you wanted to, you could not go forward, nor backward, nor to the right, nor to the left. This is a kind of samadhi, one type of samadhi. Hakuin referred to it as feeling like you're encased in a sheet. This is his own experience he was describing, being encased in a sheet of ice 10,000 miles, stretching in all directions. Throughout, the koan remains clear. This is important. It's so easy to lose track of the koan. You get into these exotic states of mind, samadhi or other states, and people forget about the koan. But that koan, that's like losing the key. You've got to keep the koan in the mind, or get it back in the mind. That's the portal, the gate. Throughout, the koan remains clear, but you are simply unable to do anything. It's a feeling of not frustration, but a feeling that it's out of your hands now. You're working as hard as you can. All of your energies are bearing down on this koan, and yet you feel stymied. You can't go forward or backward or anything else. It's a kind of a static state. You are simply unable to do anything. Moreover, although such a state has been reached, don't allow even the tiniest thought of having realized anything to occur. Such thoughts are a disease of the mind. Instead, in utmost earnestness, hold firmly to the koan and continue with the meditation. With such efforts, you will find that even without consciously raising the koan, it will be present of its own accord. And without consciously thinking of the koan, the awareness of it will always be there. At this time, when you sit, the koan sits. When you stand, the koan stands. And when you lie down, the koan lies down. When this occurs, you can truly say that the koan is present everywhere and that the practice is progressing well. Nevertheless, you must continue to persevere diligently, for there is still the danger of regressing. Upon reaching such a state, it is important to consult a wise teacher about how to proceed further with the practice. Because, on the one hand, it is easy to mistake such experiences for an awakening, and on the other, you simply may be at a loss as to what should next be done. Now, a wise teacher in this case is one who is able to clearly show the way ahead so that your practice can progress. However, there are some teachers who, through a lack of understanding, will tell you to select another koan at this point. But this is not good advice, and such persons are unwise teachers. At this time, that which stands between yourself and awakening is as thin as a single sheet of white paper. At this time, you need to proceed with the same keen determination and enthusiasm as a beginner. Now the moment has come to raise the final resolve. At the outset of the practice, your resolve can be compared to soaking the... Can be compared to soaking in water the straw with which to make sandals. So that's something that we're not familiar with, but the sandals that the Zen monks, nuns wear are made of straw, and this is part of that whole thing. So there's, up to now, it can be compared to soaking. Now, as the practice approaches its goal, your final resolve must be similar to that of someone who has to slash through an impossible knot with a single stroke of his sword. A single stroke, not hacking at it, just whoosh. All other concerns must be indiscriminately cast aside. If you are to die, then you will die. If you are to live, then you will live. Through developing such determination, the task can now be completed within 1 week. Thus, realizing this to be a very critical moment, you should prepare yourself with all intensity for one more bout. This, then, is the final resolve. I'm guessing that there are people who hear these kind of exhortations and descriptions and go a little bit limp at the prospect of having to go through all this. But it's nothing. It's only in thinking about it that it seems so formidable. It's just a matter of just pouring yourself into the practice, whatever it is, trusting it, putting everything into that, and the practice will lead you through all these hurdles. The thing now is to forget all of this. Forget everything that he said, that I said, and just entrust your practice alone. That's all you need. You don't need to remember any of this. Just trust your practice. And that will do everything. Stop now and recite the four vows.